This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture with me, Lim Soo Ann. The Healthiest Workplace by AIA Vitality 2019 survey results were recently released, and that looked at the health and well-being of employees around Asia-Pacific, and this included Malaysia. So I caught up with Dr. Christian Van Stoke, who's Executive Vice President of RAND Europe, on location right after the Malaysia's Healthiest Workplace Summit to find out more about what the results of the survey indicated to employers and what employees can learn from them. So here's our conversation.
Back in 2018, last year, right, from what I've read, Malaysia was about one-third of all the organizations that participated in Asia. So how did we do this year, especially in this region? How many organizations did we see participating?
Well, we saw quite a significant uplift in, in a number of organizations that participated. So we have about 230 organizations participating this year, which is a substantial increase. I think I think it's almost double from the previous year. So it strikes me that this is a topic, health and well-being in the workplace, that is really coming to the forefront in Malaysia. And obviously, corporates and employers are becoming increasingly interested in it. So that's really good news.
And you said that's almost like a doubling of it, right? Do you think that's a good sign for the future, that more employers are taking note of the well-being of their employees and perhaps more will join in?
I think so. I think it's always good when of course, employers are interested in a topic, and this shows interest. I think where probably Malaysia is still struggling is that there's maybe a little bit of an implementation deficit still. So I think employers are naturally curious about the topic. They don't necessarily know what to do about it. You know, so that's I think that's a lot of employers are trying to look for answers. And trying to find answers. And hopefully through the initiative, they can find some of those answers.
And this survey, so you looked at quite a number of employees in among the organizations that you surveyed in Malaysia. What were the gender and age demographics that you saw in this survey? Were they significant?
Well, so I would say that the average participant in the survey is most likely to be female and most likely to be about 35 years old. So it tends to be a little bit on the younger side. Certainly, if it compared to surveys I run in the United Kingdom, where I'm originally from. So in Malaysia, the population is a little bit younger, but we know that's the case. And surprisingly, in a survey of this nature, more females are participating than males, which is maybe women find it easier to answer these surveys. Who knows?
Is it very different from other countries that the more women tend to participate?
Not really. I think the main difference between Asia and other countries that we, and Malaysia, of course, as being part of Asia, and in the countries that we survey is different, is that the population is a bit younger, I would say. And which is also, of course, a fact of a simple fact of demographics here.
And with this workplace survey, right, what is this report trying to tell the employers and the employees about the health of the organization?
So I think the reports. So I have to say, there's two reports. So as you know, there's an employer survey, which we which a company representative, typically an HR director, fills out, and then there's an employee survey, and the employees get a feedback report as well. Which we're basically telling the employees what their main health risks are. So it basically gives the employees some information. They might want to take some action on the back of it. But in terms of employers, that was your question, obviously. What employers are trying to do, what we're trying to get employers to do with this information is that we're trying to show them what their main health risks are in the workplace and also where those health risks sit. So in which groups have those health risks and what the particular risks are. And that's hopefully allows them to take some action. The sad reality is that many employers do quite a bit for their employees, but they might not be doing the right things in the right areas. And so I think that's the challenge. So it's the issue is around coverage. Which groups are you actually targeting in your interventions or your programs? And then, of course, which risks are you trying to target? So you're trying to do both of those things.
And is it particularly difficult for employers to target certain groups, especially if, you know, considering the demographic of your in a particular workplace that might vary quite a bit? So does that make it more difficult for employees to target interventions?
I think so. I think typically an organization, especially a large organization, consists of many different types of employees, not just in terms of demographics, but also different types of jobs typically. And I think by and large employers do not really necessarily think about these different subcultures that they might have within their organization, and also, quite frankly, different income groups. So providing some of that information can actually be quite useful in actually the targeting of interventions.
So in your survey, you looked at quite a few indicators. You looked at physical activity, you looked at mental health, sleep, smoking, that's quite lifestyle choices. Which of these stood out to you the most?
So I always like to start with outcome measures. So really, what are kind of the outcome measures that you're interested in? One is the number of health risks that a population has, so in terms of the workforce, and that tends to be quite high in Malaysia. The two dominant factors there are probably physical inactivity. About 66% of Malaysians are physically inactive. And of course, being at risk for nutrition, poor diet. About 90% of Malaysians have a poor diet, unbalanced diet. And of course, that then plays a role in the number of health risks that an individual has, because you automatically, in many cases, have two already. Another fact, an outcome I like to look at is staff engagement. And so what's interesting is that there is a quite a large cohort of Malaysians who are actually have show low engagement in the workforce. That typically is a factor of a very sort of a poor work environment in some ways, a work environment that's characterized by bullying. So this is, 20% of Malaysians in the workforce actually report being bullied, at least some of the times, and also other factors around work environment that can be challenging. So, for instance, Malaysians tend to have very little choice in what they do at work, which is different perhaps from other types of countries. A final component, and which always gets a lot of attention, is what we call productivity loss, which is basically the sum of absenteeism, which is basically when people are absent from work because they're ill, and presenteeism. Presenteeism is a slightly more difficult concept, and it's a bit more invisible. And this is when people are actually at work, but they are in suboptimal health, so that's affecting their productivity at work. And we can measure that. And that measurement shows that Malaysian economy is losing about 73 productive days a year on average per employee, which is about the same as saying that companies start being productive again in April, if you think about the number of working days being lost. Most of that is due to presenteeism. Then if you start thinking about the drivers of presenteeism, there's obviously mental health is a huge component of that. Mental health is also a challenge in Malaysia.
And you know, speaking about mental health, you said there was a lot of bullying and people experience bullying at work. What can employers do in that sense to help curb that?
So this gets to the essence of the matter. This is basically around work culture, and it basically requires a more holistic approach to the health and well-being of staff and employees. And obviously, it is very difficult to address bullying without actually thinking about line manager behavior, senior leadership role modeling, other things you might be doing in a work environment. So it gets into the real essence of what an organization is. But of course, if you really want to make headway into that, you have to start sort of thinking about how you can tweak that culture, how you can tweak that work environment. And that's the real challenge, really.
But then, and especially in Malaysia here, right, we are talking about mental health more and more, but there is still that stigma. So how do employers get the message across to their employees that there won't be a stigma in that workplace, that employees can speak up without fearing that there will be backlash against them?
It's a very good point. The key thing to do is, of course, education and awareness, but that's not sufficient in and by itself. So there's a lot of different interventions that focus on creating more awareness around mental health issues in the workplace. And essentially, what you have to do is actually have to reach an average employee, but also you have to reach their line manager, because, of course, the line manager is the person who can take action in terms of what happens with an employee, and also typically tends to be the barrier often. But that's not enough in and by itself. You also have to offer creating awareness is, of course, one part of the puzzle, but you have to create opportunities for actually those mental health issues to be addressed. So that requires counseling. In some cases, that there's digital apps available. There's a variety of different things that can be done. But those things have to be available, those interventions, those programs have to be available to employees for us to really make progress in mental health. Yeah.
And before that, you also mentioned physical activity, right? I think there was about 65.9% don't participate in physical activity. Considering that many Malaysians are very, especially in the workplace, right? We live sedentary lifestyles. We sit in the office chair from 8 to 5. Are there ways for the company to encourage a workplace that that has more physical activity around the office?
Yeah, I think there's a lot you can do, actually. So the physical activity is an interesting one because, you know, nobody's truly physically inactive, right? But the benchmark for being physically active is about 150 minutes of moderate activity a week. So that's the cutoff. So if you do 75 minutes of vigorous activity, let's say you go to the gym and you work out and so on, that counts double. So that gets you to 150 minutes as well. So what we're looking at is actually moderate behavior changes in individuals, sometimes as little as 4 or 5 minutes a week. Per day, so that adds up to about 30 minutes a week, to actually make that change. So this is sometimes just walking to the station, it's walking maybe to get your lunch. These type of things can make a massive difference already. Now, there's a number of different things that can be done to encourage that. One is, you know, around incentives, you know, so you can incentivize people to become more physically active. There's a really interesting program in the United Kingdom where people get an Apple Watch. But they get to keep it only if they do a certain level of physical activity. So this is what we call a loss-framed incentive. So you lose the Apple Watch if you don't keep up your physical activity. So basically you get something for free, but the only way you keep it is actually if you do the physical activity. That shows really interesting results. Obviously, there is also the participation in programs. So typically what we see is that the participation in programs, health and well-being programs in the workplace, is very low. So if you increase that participation, you're also likely to see more impact in terms of physical activity.
Do we know why participation tends to be low in these programs?
Well, there's probably two different factors. There's a variety of factors, but I'll focus on two. One is the time during work to actually participate and during working hours. So, you know, you have to have employers who allow you to participate in those programs. But really what is almost a more fundamental problem is that most employees are not aware that these programs exist. So well-meaning HR directors typically put a lot of programs in place, but then fail to really adequately promote them and communicate them to staff. So the staff is not aware that these programs are there. So you cannot participate in something that you don't know exists, really.
So how can employers make sure that they continuously communicate that to the staff, right, that we have these items available?
I think you hit the nail on the head. Continuous is the main adjective here. This requires continuous effort. And also, you have to think about how people, engage with information. And of course, you have to give different messages to people at different times of the year. You might want to use World Physical Activity Day to actually highlight the case. There's different hooks that you can use to actually make things relevant to individuals. Unfortunately, many employers do not have the imagination or do not put in the effort to actually do that. And I think that's part of the problem.
That was the first part of my conversation with Dr. Christian Van Stoke, Executive Vice President of RAND Europe, on the results of the Healthiest Workplace by AIA Vitality 2019 survey. We'll find out more about the rest of the survey results after this break. You're listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, Lim Suan. Before the break, you were listening to part of my conversation with Executive Vice President of RAND Europe, Dr. Christian Van Stoke, where we were speaking about the results of AIA Vitality's Healthiest Workplace survey. And now, here's the rest of our conversation.
And you also mentioned that 90% of the employees surveyed are not eating healthily. What are some of the factors that are preventing people from doing so?
I don't know. It's a really, really good question. I come to Malaysia a lot, and at least once a year. And this is a country that's blessed with wonderful vegetables, wonderful fruit, all kinds of wonderful food. Unfortunately, it's also blessed with some very high fat, treats and snacks and lunches and breakfast and so on. And my guess is there's a food culture here that is that steers people towards some of those high fat choices. And I think it's a real fundamental problem. So trans fats or high fats is a real significant issue in Malaysia, and you can see it in the survey. But of course, there's also a complete absence of consumption of fruit as well, which I find rather bizarre for a wonderful tropical country that has some of these amazing choices. So I think it's again, we're talking about cultural changes and making changes to the food environment as well. Making sure that when you go to the buffet, that those high fat options are not available. You know, you have to create those ecosystems where people do not make those choices. Right?
Do you see that busy schedules are are factoring in this problem of accessing or choosing to eat healthier foods?
Well, I think our busy lifestyles play into many of the things that we just mentioned. I think it plays into our nutritional choices, but also in the choices we make around physical activity. Quite frankly, I think if you work the long hours that Malaysians do, and actually, you know, with some of the impact on their sleeping patterns, the last thing probably you want to do in the evening is go to a gym or actually cook a healthy meal and so on. It's probably easier to make those choices. Again, I think there's an ecosystem argument here. Maybe we need to hold delivery companies to account and actually say, well, actually, you know, you have to offer healthier food options. And certainly there are initiatives on the way in some of the European countries that I'm familiar with that try to do exactly that.
What sort of initiatives?
Well, initiatives about creating healthier food options in terms of delivery, in terms of actually food environments, different food environments and so on.
So placing the part of the responsibility on these delivery companies to
Correct.
have these choices up front rather than putting
Correct.
The easy
Or at least
ones.
Being able to communicate exactly what's in the food allowing consumers to make a choice on the basis of that information.
All right. And we also saw, you also surveyed smoking in the workplace, right? I think it's something of a slight decrease from 11.1 to 9%.
Yeah, that is somewhat surprising. I think it's in a sense. What we don't ask about in the survey is vaping. So we don't know if there's a substitution effect from people switching from traditional cigarettes and smoking to vaping type products. Although I believe that there are some issues about availability in Malaysia and around those products. But we don't know for a fact. What we do see in the survey, which is quite interesting, is that those people who smoke are really quite motivated to change their behavior. So I think they're just looking for a little bit of help. So I think about close to 60-65% of smokers actually want to change their behavior.
Is it important then for the organization to make sure that they have incentives in place if smokers want to change, right? That employers have these incentives, that they communicate this so that they can have these options?
I would think so. I mean, to get smoking together with blood pressure are probably the two things that contribute most to your mortality risk. So if you really want to become healthier, then obviously stopping smoking and getting your blood pressure under control are two essential factors.
But then also, right, I'm also thinking that we do have incentives in place. The government, for example, has free aid in place, but people, I don't know whether people don't know about this or people are not choosing to access them, right? So what can we do to make it different if we want to encourage more people to take that first step towards quitting smoking?
Yeah, people's behavior is quite complex, and getting people to change behavior is complex as well. I mean, we spoke about incentives before. I think there's something to that. I know that in certain contexts, I know in the Scottish healthcare system, you know, because it's such a burden on the system, smokers are being incentivized, so they get money if they comply with a smoking cessation program. So this means that if you comply with the smoking cessation program, of course, the payments add up. And so you get full payment throughout the smoking cessation program. Of course, you can imagine that this is controversial. Paying people to do anything is controversial because you're actually, you know, some people would see this as being rewarded for smoking almost. But in essence, the impact of smoking is so bad for society that it's better for society to pay people to stop doing it.
And what impact do we see people who smoke have on the productivity in the workplace?
So it has an impact for sure, but it's not as big in terms of the productivity aspect as you might think. And the reason for that is, of course, smoking is a long-term issue. So it will increase your mortality risk and will cut down your life expectancy, but it might not be that visible directly in productivity. Productivity is quite a short-term measure, if you think about it. It's how you felt the last week or the last month, right? Smoking doesn't necessarily play a part in that as much as some other issues like mental health, for instance. But of course, if you think about longer term health, smoking is of course a really very significant factor.
And sleep also is one of the issues that is linked to both, I mean, short term and long term health, right? What were some of the findings about sleep in Malaysia?
So sleep is not entirely surprising in Malaysia. In many Asian countries, sleep is perhaps not as valued as it could be. This is an always on society. When I come to Asia, I'm always astonished about the levels of activity late at night in these cities. People don't perhaps value sleep in the same way. The problem with sleep, of course, is that, and I think it's about 55% of Malaysians sleep fewer than 7 hours. There's also a perception that sleep is a sort of seen as a degree of laziness in a way, mm-hmm. Which is also quite interesting, and that more successful people need fewer hours of sleep. What's interesting in the data that we find is that, you know, if you sleep fewer than 8 hours, and every hour you sleep fewer than those 8 hours, you're also your obesity risk increases and also your income drops. So the whole concept of more successful people requiring less sleep is basically not seen in this data. So in fact, lack of sleep seems to be something that's affecting low income groups a lot more.
Do you think that people are struggling to find that balance between work and life?
Yeah, absolutely. And and I think there's a number of confounding factors. You know, I had the joy of trying to get into Kuala Lumpur from the airport yesterday in a thunderstorm and so on. And it took me a good hour to go a couple of miles. So commuting is, of course, a real issue. And we know that commuting has a really negative impact on people's health. You know, so that is a critical issue. And there's a number of those kind of factors as well that play a part in sleep.
And I also want to touch on clinical health issues like obesity, musculoskeletal disorders. A lot of Malaysians have these chronic issues. Malaysia is known to have high number of NCDs and non-communicable diseases and growing. Do you see high numbers from the results in the survey?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think Malaysia is a relatively young population. The population will age quite rapidly, I think, in the coming decades, as many countries in Asia. I think already, if you look at chronic conditions, there's about 32% of the workforce seems to have a chronic condition, or at least reported in the survey. You have 80% of employees reporting a musculoskeletal condition. So this is neck pain or back pain or elbow pain and so on. So you see some worrying statistics, which have to do, of course, with the fact, you know, what you mentioned earlier, that many jobs are now desk-based and we don't exercise enough, which this physical activity inactivity comes in. So there are some areas for concern. I think there's another way of flipping this, though. And I would say that the areas of concern are also wonderful opportunities in a way, because I think with as I was explaining, for physical inactivity, with all moderate changes to people's behavior, you can make already quite significant gains. So the price is there. So it seems to me that it's just a question of changing the culture of health and getting government, employers, and other stakeholders to come together, like AIA, for instance, the insurance company, to actually make that significant change that is required.
And you mentioned neck and back pain, and it's stuff like this, right? It's as simple as fixing your posture, isn't it? It's sitting straighter at your desk, or perhaps even have a higher desk and lower keyboard. You can see places where employers can easily come in with this, perhaps provide higher desks and extra keyboards that you can do to help employees fix their posture, because it's something as simple as that. If you feel better, if you don't have back pain, then you would probably work better at your job.
I think you're spot on. I mean, it's a concept we call reasonable adjustments, and you know, it's very straightforward for an HR team to screen people in an office and try to figure out how they're sitting, how they're working, and so on. And very small adjustments can make a very significant difference to people's lives and the pain that they might have due to musculoskeletal issues.
But in the survey, do you find that people are aware of their health risks? Do people think that they're healthy, or people think that they're relatively unhealthy?
So people are eternal optimists. And I think we need to be this to survive, right, in a complex world. But that also means that we have no perception of what our real health risks are. So what's interesting is that well over 40% of people have four or more health risks. So this might mean smoking, alcohol, it might be high blood pressure, it might be cholesterol issues and glucose and so on. That they believe that they're in good to very good health. So we're eternal optimists about our own health, which also means that, of course, changing people's behavior cannot just rely on letting people get on with it, because there are good reasons why we don't change our behavior, mostly because we think we're in perfectly good health, even if we're not.
Are we just in denial over this, and that makes it more difficult for employers to introduce these steps? Because if people are overly optimistic, right? They think they're in good health. Then employers come in with their different interventions. Aren't employees just going to think that, well, I'm in good health, why do I need to take up these interventions?
That is one factor, but also employers typically do not focus their interventions on their main risks, as I mentioned before. So let's say that 51%, as in Malaysia, of your employees have at least one dimension of work-related stress. And you have 45% of Malaysian employers who do not offer anything on mental health, for instance. So there's a misalignment between some of the risks that employers face and also some and the interventions they offer to their employees. So I agree with you. It's difficult to change people's behavior. It's quite sticky behavior in many cases. But of course, it doesn't help if you actually if employers do not target the behavior in the first place, right? Or public health officials, for that matter.
And you mentioned briefly earlier about presenteeism and absenteeism, right, and how that can have great impacts on the workplace. Could you briefly go through again what were our results and perhaps how did we compare to other countries in the region? Are we doing better? Are we doing worse?
So, you know, the easiest way to communicate it is about 73 days, I believe it is in Malaysia, in terms of working days being lost. So this gets you to that April start date in terms of productivity loss. But of course, the vast majority of that is presenteeism. So typically you will find that, a small number of days, I think it's about 6 days, are being lost to absenteeism, and the rest of it is presenteeism. So that makes it a little bit more difficult because, of course, absenteeism is the thing that is quite visible. Mm-hmm. In terms of comparison with other countries, the Asian countries do have a very high productivity loss in general compared to other countries that I'm familiar with. So that would be the UK. Australia is also lumped together with some of the Asian countries, but shows very different profile. And they tend to have lower productivity loss in Australia as well. So there seems to be something specific about the Asian context, but even within the Asian context, Malaysia is quite high. Mm. So that is probably something that is worrying, and but it's also an opportunity because ultimately, if you can make some changes there, as I always say, this is a shared value proposition, right? So if you change or improve the health and well-being of employees, it's good for society, but it's also good for the bottom line of businesses. Mm-hmm. So businesses really should have an incentive to actually take this serious.
So I had a look at the overall results of the survey. From what I could see, there were only minor changes, good changes in some categories, but most of them were quite minor across the board, right? Is that because these changes are long-term changes that will take time to implement, or does it show, or are we just going back to the fact that people just don't want to change?
So I think it's a complex issue. So there's a multitude of reasons. So first of all, you're right. Some of these things are long-term changes, and you can't expect changes to happen in a year or two. So that's the first point. Also, as you're right, humans do not readily change their behavior. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that people do not plan for the long term, right? So that means that people do not like to engage with their mortality, with their longer term health. They live in the now, and sometimes having a nice bowl of fatty food is more rewarding in the now than thinking about the long term consequences by keep eating that kind of food. But having said that, one of the factors that I did notice is that even though employers are interested in this topic and really want to figure out what to do about the health and well being of their employees, there is still an absence of action.
From
the employers. So so that surprised me to some extent, because if you look at the numbers and if you look at the productivity losses that some of these employers incur, and also low staff engagement and all of these things that we know drive business outcomes, you would have expected perhaps a little bit more. It's perhaps a function of where Malaysia is on the journey. Of course, in the United Kingdom, the country I'm from, we've had about 15 years of being on this journey. So maybe I'm becoming a little bit of impatient, having been on a 15-year long journey, and now in Malaysia being on a journey that has only lasted 2 years. So I expect Malaysia hopefully to start moving significantly on this issue in the next couple of years or few years.
Mm. And so you think in the next couple of years we will see some more significant changes in these areas?
Well, what I would expect, and you can check with me when I come back next time. But what I would expect employers to really significantly change their offer to employees and the health and well-being offer, I expect much more work between the insurance companies and the employers to actually make these changes, because of course insurance companies are paying out a lot of claims, which they don't like either. And I expect the government to get more involved, though I expect changes to start happening. And of course, that eventually feeds through into the system.
Mm. And these are all changes that take all stakeholders to be involved, not just one part, right?
Correct. I think it's a mutually reinforcing message. I mean, it's hard to do this when A, your competitors are not doing it, when your insurance company doesn't care, and your government doesn't give you any instructions, right? So these things are tricky. And we're talking about humans, you know, not necessarily changing their behaviors quickly. Of course, HR directors and senior executives in businesses are also humans, right? So they're fixed on doing certain, you know, certain things in a certain way. And they have to change their behavior as well in order to for us to move on this.
And so moving forward, right, considering the results of this survey and perhaps the past 2 years when it's been done, what can employers do with these results moving forward? What are some of the points that they should take and run with it?
So I thought there were some really interesting aspects. So first of all, doing interventions and a well-being program in isolation, and by that I mean just focusing on interventions and not looking at the wider work environment and work culture is a mistake. So you have to think of all of these things as working together. You cannot put an intervention in place and then allow your line manager to bully their his or her employees. You have to really address all of these things at the same time, which can be a challenge. The other thing is that employers are already doing quite a bit for their employees. Unfortunately, the employees don't know about it. So creating awareness, communicating better, and driving participation in existing interventions would already make a big difference. I think the coverage point that I was making is that you know, when you do have interventions and programs, you need to actually make sure that they cover the at-risk population in your organization, and you have to define what that population is, and also the main health risks that exist within your organization. So it's kind of an intelligence-led kind of approach, and many employers put together quite a random bunch of interventions or programs. And I think, quite frankly, we need to see some investment going into it as well by employers. And the investment will pay off because they're losing all this money, so why wouldn't you invest in health and well-being? Seems to me a no-brainer, but look, I've been thinking about this for 15 years.
And you want to see the employers starting early enough, right? Not later when perhaps health risks have already manifested quite late and then it will take more work to go into it. You want prevention.
Correct. I mean, I think this all of this work is around prevention, really. I think when somebody gets really ill and so on, you're too late. I mean, you're already getting into a trajectory often where it sometimes can be very difficult to keep somebody in employment. It can be very difficult to keep them in the workplace and so on. You don't want necessarily somebody who has a common mental health issue to become clinically depressed. There's ways that you can intervene earlier. So you're absolutely spot on. You know, prevention is not an easy game to be in. But of course, the workplace is a wonderful place to try to do it because we spend, I don't know, 50 to 60% of our waking time, well, probably all our time in the workplace. So we are there an awful lot. So obviously it's not an easy place, but it's a very good place to reach people.
That was a recorded interview with Dr. Christian Van Stoke, Executive Vice President of RAND Europe. He was in Kuala Lumpur recently to attend the Malaysia's Healthiest Workplace Summit, and that's where I spoke to him about the results of the Healthiest Workplace by AIA Vitality 2019 survey, and we discussed how Malaysian employees are doing in their respective workplaces and what employers and organisations can learn from these results in their bid to improve the health and well-being of their employees. This has been Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.